Mike Lupica Show.
New York Daily News columnist and best-selling author.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody wants everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A billion-dollar industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is Mike Lupica Show. Here's Mike Lupica.
Welcome to the Mike Lupica Show. Before we talk to today's guest, Bill Sims, listen, these days you can get practically everything on demand. Take my podcast, for example. Listen whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. So why are you still making time-consuming trips to the post office when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? Anything you can do at the post office, you can now do right from your desk with Stamps.com. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes, so you can get postage whenever you need it, 24/7. Stamps.com is so simple to use and will free you of the hassle of visiting the post office. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Lupica, for this special offer. A four-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Lupica. That's Stamps.com and enter Lupica. My guest today, and I have to tell you going in, I grew up a Giants fan in upstate New York, is my favorite Giant of all time, Phil Sims, and he is the only athlete I have ever met who actually debates me on whether or not he belongs in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, because every time I tell you that you do, you explain to me why you don't. Could you explain to our listeners why that is?
Oh, you're going to make me do this again?
Yes.
You know, well, you know, how about this? Why don't we start out this way? Let me see. My first recollection of Mike Lupica, always the first story that comes to my mind, and you know what's coming, is in 1987 in January, we're ready to play in the Super Bowl, my dream that I thought would never happen. I'm going to play in the game. It's a great week.
Yeah.
We are practicing awesome. It's Friday. It's my last press conference. Can you imagine doing this today? We were sitting around a table, you, me, and what would you say, about four other writers?
Maybe four tops. It was, however many chairs there were at the table, there was no overflow, and there we are. We're sitting with one of the two Super Bowl quarterbacks.
And there I am, and it's great, and we're getting ready to get on the bus to go for our final practice. And big Mike Lupica says, Phil, do you understand, no matter how you play in this game, even if you play great, if the Giants lose, that all the Giant fans are going to blame you? And I think that's a direct quote. And I just was like, wow, I was having such a great week, and you put that in my head. But, well.
Yeah, but obviously.
But I just remember getting on the bus going, dang, what a thing to say to me right before I'm getting ready to. Oh, so I just remember every time I – every day I open up the papers, I see your article, and I think that story comes to my mind. So,
that's where we'll
start today.
We're talking to Phil, but obviously, can we look at the positives in that statement? Because it's not exactly like you went out and tripped over yourself, because you completed 22 out of 25 passes and played as close to a perfect game as any Super Bowl quarterback ever did.
It was a great day, Mike. It really was, you know, in many, many ways. Of course, winning changes everything. And, you know, I tell players, even to this day, I think I told a couple Carolina Panther football players, I was at their practice and they were asking me some questions. And I said, let me tell you something. When you stand in the tunnel and they wait to announce your team, as you stand there, it's going to seem like you're going to be there for an hour. And it's going to be the greatest time of your life, because it's going to meet all the expectations you have of playing in the Super Bowl. And when I tell the story to them, you know, and the athlete has changed, of course, in today's world, I could see them all just going, oh, my gosh, you know, because it was that great. And, yeah, that moment is great because we went out and won. I wouldn't cherish that moment of standing in the tunnel near as much as I do now if we'd have went out there and somehow lost that game.
Phil, no high-level, high-performing athlete, confident athlete I ever met was actually surprised when they did well. They've always expected to do well. But could you, in your best dreams, your biggest dreams about that day, think that, and you know that the three incompletions, how close you were to throwing a perfect game?
Yeah, could I ever dream it? No. Did I ever think that it would happen that week? No. It was just a different era. We were a different type of football team. Even maybe for that era, you know, we were a running, physical team. We did throw a lot late that year. We were hot in making plays. You know, we just made big plays, it seemed like, constantly in offense. That's what Bill Parcells like. But it wasn't like we were doing it with high-percentage passes. It was, you know, I remember I tell people all the time, stat sheets, I'd get on the bus and somebody'd have the stat sheets. I said, oh, let me look at it. And I would be 16 for 34, and I'd go, that was a pretty good day, you know. And, you know, now if you went 16 for 34 and whatever and didn't, they'd lead SportsCenter off that maybe they might have had change of quarterback or, you know, something. So it just, the thought process, the way the game was played, so differently. We played even a different style than the Denver Broncos did. It was, you know, I just thought going into the game that week to finish the story, I figured Lawrence Taylor would probably be the most valuable player if we won because he would do something really outstanding. Or I thought Joe Morris, who had a terrific year for us running the football, would be the difference too. But I never even thought about it that, hey, I might be that guy. It didn't cross my mind. I didn't waste one single second thinking about it. And maybe that was part of the reason why I had some success that day, because my mind was clear and it was free.
In all the years since, has it made you sad to see a friend, teammate, and iconic player like Lawrence have the troubles he's had away from the field?
Well, yes, it does. It does. Of course it does. I had kind of a unique relationship with him. It's hard to even explain. I have a picture here. I'm sitting in my office now, and it's me and Lawrence Taylor hugging after I had just thrown a touchdown pass against the Chicago Bears in 1993, late in the game to win it. And I can't tell you, of all the touchdown passes I threw as a Giant, I'm going to say almost every one, the first person that hugged me was Lawrence Taylor after every one. He was always out. So to see him go through these troubles, you know, it does bother me. You know, I wish it could have gone differently. He could have done me. But we could say that about a lot of people in life. We're all not built the same. Thank God we're not. You know, there's people that have, you know, different things they want to do off the field and live their life one way, and you and I have our own ways of living or whatever. But it is sad to see that some of the troubles he's got into. I've seen him, though, he straightened his life out. Here he is in the news again here the last couple of days. I don't mean to laugh, but I do know his wife just enough. I've met her a few times, and yeah. I'm sure she threw something at Lawrence. I'm pretty sure he probably deserved something thrown at him, so I don't mean to make fun of it, but it sounds like everything is okay there on that front.
You know, we've joked for all the time we've known each other that my favorite thing when you would be on the sideline is when the camera would show you standing next to Bill Parcells. And you're talking and he's talking and you're not looking at each other. You're both facing straight ahead. And I could always tell by the body language that there were just hideous things being said between the two of you.
Well, yes, you're probably right. And, you know, it's really, you know, and I laugh about it all the time. It's kind of funny. It's even funnier to me now to think that I had that relationship with a head coach of the New York Giants. Can you imagine any quarterback having that relationship with the head coach now?
No.
The NFL? No, now, you know, they're both, you know, CEOs of big corporations. I mean, the quarterbacks and the head coaches, and you know, the way they look and they talk, and it's just amazing. And Bill, you know, listen, Bill thrived and loved conflict. That's how what motivated him, kept him going, and that's how he thought he could keep everybody on edge. And it worked. He did it in many places, and that's what he did to us. And, you know, I think once he knew he could say whatever he wanted to you, that opened up a big door. And I would say there's probably about 10 guys on the Giant football team that, man, you know, he never thought about what he was going to say to us. He just let it go. So I got many of those speeches walking on the field, walking off the field, during timeouts, and almost basically every day of the 8 years that he was there with the Giants in practice. And it was, you know, looking back, it's funny. I'm glad it happened, but it was stressful. And, you know, it was 8 years of every day, here comes Bill. Oh, my gosh, what is it? You know, so I just can't even explain to people. Can you imagine going to work? Sometimes I speak in front of an audience. I say, can you imagine going to work? And as you walked into your office, your boss is there and goes, all right, son, if you don't have a good day today, I don't know what I'm going to do. I might have to fire you. And, you know, and these things would happen to us. And. Yeah. You know, Sims, I couldn't sleep last night. You were so bad in practice yesterday. And I'm like, yeah, I just walked in the locker room. I'm trying to get my wits around. He goes, I'm tossing and turning. And my wife says, what's the matter, Bill? And I said, my effing quarterback can't complete a pass. That's what's the matter with me. And just, oh, my gosh. You know, so now go and sit in the meetings and learn all day. And what kind of pressure, Mike, do you think I felt going out to practice that afternoon?
No, it was like the same kind of. No, it's the same kind of pressure I put on you before the Super Bowl. It's exactly, you know, we had
that's what he believed in. That's what he did, and that was at his peak. Those 8 years he coached the Giants, he was at his peak because of his age, you know, his energy, and the players. Now, age, the type of game, and the players changed. You know, as he went into all the other jobs, so he changed, you know, he changed too, and he couldn't quite coach them, not quite the same way that he coached us, but some of those Dallas Cowboys and some of those New England Patriots, all of them, they got a little taste of it, but nothing like the Giant players did during his 8 years there.
Phil, now I'm going to bollocks this story, so you tell it. You were holding out, and you weren't answering your phone. Is it true that he then went to the late Tim Merritt, God rest his soul, somehow he found out what it would take to get the deal done, and did he send either a New Jersey cop or state trooper to your house who told you, pick up the phone?
Yes, he sent a cop. He sent a policeman to my house. Tell Sims I'm trying to call him and pick up the damn phone. That is true.
And then he told me that he said to you, what will it take to get the deal done? And you told him, and he said, stay right there. And he called Tim, and that's how the deal got done.
To make the story short, that's how it went. And the in-between was, Sims, I mean, how much money do you need? Like, you know, I was, you know, Bill, I just want to be paid. Just pay me like Ken O'Brien's being paid for the Jets. And that's really all I wanted, was to be in the same ballpark as Ken O'Brien. Because our contracts both were up that year when our seasons went over. Now, Ken O'Brien had a really good, solid career with the Jets. You know, people downplay that. But he signed a new contract, I think, the day after the season was over. I had to hold out at camp to get the contract to somewhat match his. I had to hold out. I'm not sure how many weeks I was out, 2, 3. I was getting nervous knowing that I would have a hard time getting ready for the regular season if I didn't go in. And, you know, that's what happened. We finally got it done. So, you know, but how can you imagine? How do you talk to your head coach? How much money do you need, Sims? I mean, Bill, it never seemed I didn't see you coaching for free, but that is true. It worked out, and of course, I'm glad it did.
Phil, all this time later, and I'm not speaking for you, is the biggest hole in your heart about your career that you got hurt before the Giants won that second Super Bowl?
No, I don't think it is. It's not. I'm proud of the second one. You know, sure, it's a little different when the first one I played, but I played such a big part in that whole year. I think when I think about my career, if I ever, you know, I'm not a reminiscer. I try to move on. I always have. We've had these conversations, you and I, many times, Mike.
Yep. Yep.
This is like the Hall of Fame. I don't think about it. I've never wasted one ounce of energy thinking about how to get in it or what to do or why I'm not in it. Never, not an ounce. It just doesn't cross my mind. But I think about my career, I wish I just knew a little more. In other words, I kind of wish I would have played a little bit of a different style and would have known to not take certain hits, knowing there was another play, the next play, and protected myself a little more, because I missed a lot of valuable time. You know, even that year in 1990, when I did get hurt late in the year against the Buffalo Bills, actually that year I was taking less hits and kind of had changed a little bit as a quarterback, knowing, okay, there's another way to play this. You don't have to stand in there and just get, you know, just drilled to try to complete a 10-yard pass over the middle. You know, you can throw it away and wait for third down or whatever. So I think that's the one thing I think about all the time, and I tell people and tell kids, and when I throw with them, try to tell my kids, you know, there is a time to give up in this game, especially now as a quarterback. And I didn't do it enough, and it cost me years, many games, big moments. And, that's what I regret more than anything.
Phil, what has been the physical toll on you in your post-playing career? And has there been, do you ever detect a mental toll?
I'll say this. Do I worry about it? Sure. I do think about it. And, you know, I'm 60 years old, and I go, oh, what's so-and-so's name? And, of course, the first thing, you know, we all get nervous about it, especially now with everything that's written and, you know,
right,
all the other things that go on with people as they get older. Not that 60's old. I'm not saying that. But mentally, I feel good. I feel sharp. I do everything there is to keep me mentally sharp. I read a lot. I eat. You know, I do the diet. I exercise almost every single day. The physical toll, I would say as time goes on, I do feel it more and more. And you know, is it from football? Sure, that's some of it, Mike. But I was telling a guy last Friday, I was actually working out in the gym, and he was working out. I said, yeah. I said, I wonder sometimes why this aches and that aches. Let's see. I played baseball in the summers until the summer before I was drafted.
Right.
I mean, a lot. All the work. I played tennis like it was a religion during the off seasons of my career. I played golf. I hit golf balls in the range for some days, 6 and 7 and 8 hours. I played basketball in the off season. I trained. Well, don't wonder I have aches and pains.
Right.
So, you know, so it's hard just to sit there and say that it's football. The training for it, you know, sometimes I went a little overboard on that, and that could have been part of it too. And that's probably the other thing when I look at it now and what I know and see players, because they know so much more science about training and eating and also all the ways that they can take care of themselves. None of those were available to us when we played. And, you know, the money's one thing. I don't care. But that part makes me a little jealous too.
We're both the fathers of sons. Mine never wanted to play football. They played all the other sports. If Matt and Chris were 12 and 11 or 12 and 10 now, would you have any hesitation about having them play youth football?
No, I would not. And it's not because I still make my living announcing the games. I would not hesitate. I would let them play, especially at that age. You know, that age, to me, is the safest to play. You know, when you get bigger, faster, and stronger, that's when you got to start worrying about certain things. You know, as I say to people here in town in Franklin Lakes, New Jersey, in youth football, I go, how many injuries do you really have a year? And they have to sit there and think. I said, yeah, you probably go some years and don't have any. And but I would not hesitate. But, you know, I think there's many things. This is a deep discussion. The rules, the way the game is played, the way they practice, what we know, medical technology, just everything has changed. So that, to me, makes it safer. And I think my deep love of the game, and I really mean this, when I was going to college, everybody that I grew up with, Mike, assumed that I would be a professional baseball player. They never even thought that I would be. Football didn't even enter their minds. And I remember going into my sophomore year of college going, I said, you know, I'm going to put all my efforts into playing football. I still did play summer baseball when I came home from college. But there was just something about it. It was the fact that there were so many people involved. It was so emotional. When you had success, it was such an unbelievable high and so great. It just everything about it. And, you know, I think the other thing is because it was so hard. I think that was part of the appeal, too, that it was hard and the discipline, the organization, all those things. I loved all that about it, and I still love all that to today about NFL football. Those qualities will never change. The work, being on time, being accountable, I think it's as much, maybe more in football than any other sport. So that's why I say great things about it even to this day.
Phil, do you even know how many times you were concussed when you were playing?
No, I don't know. I think about it. I've tried to count them. Real concussions, I would probably say real concussions. What's a real concussion? I
can right. tell you.
Yeah. But I did get knocked out one time just for a brief second on a Monday night game, 1987 in Chicago. Couldn't remember a play. Walked off the field. And they go, what's wrong with you? I said, I don't know. I can't remember anything. You're sending in plays. And I have no idea what they mean. And which is... shows you the difference in time. So that's what? They're basically 30 years ago.
30 years ago, yeah.
Once my head cleared a little bit and I could remember the plays, they sent me right back in. I set out probably about two or three series and went back in the game and played. And, you know, I don't remember having any headaches or any side effects from it. But I do think about, let's see. When I was 11, I played right field in baseball. A high fly ball was hit, and I ran full speed, never even slowed down, and ran right into the fence and knocked myself out. You know, I remember painting my neighbor's house and reached a little too far in the ladder to the top of the house. The ladder slipped out from under me. I fell two stories and landed, knocked myself out. You know, God knows how many times, and I last laughed, you know, there's five boys in my family and three girls. How many times in boxing matches in the basement that my older brothers just killed me? I mean, you know, they hit me in the head, and I'd, like, go down and go, oh, wow. You know, you see stars. So, and I say those, and I laugh when I say it because those were great moments and memories. But I think of that more than I do the football. That I think of, it seems like I had more of those moments like that, running into the fence, you know, falling down from the house and all that than I did in football. I didn't have the severe headaches ever. I didn't get knocked dizzy very often, any of those things. So that gives me great hope that I will not suffer for anything down the road.
And you've heard the stories, Phil. You've heard the stories, you know, Jim Kelly, well, I forget what Super Bowl, where he got back to the hotel and he couldn't remember what room he was staying in. My friend Tom Waddle, he talks about a playoff game that he can only remember half of. You've had none of that in your own life.
No, my memories, I never had it in a game, after the game, anything like that. And my memories of playing are still extremely, I don't know, you know this. Come on, you've done it for your life. The memory of players, I can remember, you know, the second play in my junior year in high school. So I can remember my first pass ever in organized football in the fifth grade. And threw it to David Greckel for about a 40-yard touchdown. He was the coach's son, so, you know, he was going to get the run. So I think that part has stayed with me, but I never had any of those moments like you described Jim Kelly had.
You know, it's funny. I'll go to golf tournaments, and I just love after the round, you know, immediately the golfer, you know, I hit it driver, five iron. And I don't want to make a big thing of this. I did make a hole-in-one on Saturday, but, you know, that's another story.
Oh, you did? Well, good for you. So that means you bought. I like that, right? They still do that,
well,
right?
You know what? Here's the thing, Phil. Should other people capitalize on my moment of triumph? Is that really a fair system where you got to buy drinks for everybody at the club?
Well, you know what? I'll just say this. Yes, it is, because it's such a great moment that you want everybody to celebrate it with you. So there you go. That's how you got to look at it. I mean, you know, how many hole in ones have you had in your golfing?
Two.
So yeah. When was the other one?
In a charity tournament, and I won a car.
Oh, my God.
And Phil, when I called my wife Taylor after this one the other day, she said, "What kind of car did you win?" I said, "No, it doesn't work like that, honey. You don't get one for every time you make a hole."
This time we lost, buddy. I actually did not. I won a car too in a golf tournament once, and so we got that in common. I didn't make a hole in one, but I hit it to 2 feet, so that won me a car. So
you know what?
I was like, "It's unbelievable."
You want to hear something great, and it's the truth, and you know this again, and as a parent. The best part of it on Saturday was that I was playing with my oldest son, and he saw it happen too.
Oh, that's pretty cool. That is great. You bring up many things just seeing it. Your son saw it. He got to share it. But playing sports, watching sports with your children, it doesn't get better than that. It's the best. Or, you know, or watching your children play, of course, but, you know, going to sporting events, all those things. I mean, your kids are getting up there. All those memories are there forever. It's wonderful. Sports, that's one thing it does. It creates great memories. You know, I'm not going to have a memory and talk about, hey, when we went to see a movie in a theater or something like that. So that's pretty cool. Your son was there to watch that happen.
We're talking with Phil Simms on the Mike Lupica Show. More with Phil in a minute. But first, I want to let you know that we are brought to you by Harry's. A Harry's shaving set will make the perfect Father's Day gift. It looks cool, it feels special, and it's something that Dad will actually use. Forget the tie or the pair of socks he's never going to wear. Get him a gift he'll love. As you've heard me say before, I've been a fan of Harry's for a while, even before they became a sponsor. The limited edition Father's Day shave set includes a matte black razor handle, a chrome razor stand, Harry's moisturizing foaming shave gel, 3 of Harry's handcrafted blade cartridges, and a travel cover, all for $40. Plus, it comes in a sleek, giftable box with the option to add custom engraving and a personalized card. Harry's also offers shaving sets starting at $15. Best part, you can order online. No hassle, and shipping to the U.S. is free for all of Harry's shave sets. Go to harrys.com right now and redeem a special offer for fans of the show. Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase with promo code Lupica. Don't wait. Economy shipping for Father's Day ends on Thursday, June 9th, so act now. That's harrys.com. Enter code Lupica at checkout to get $5 off. Get Dad something he'll actually use this Father's Day. Phil, will there ever be an end to Deflategate, or will it just be like Groundhog Day, and it will go on and on and on and on?
Oh, my gosh. I don't even know what to say about it. Once it gets into the court of law, it can go on forever. So I do think maybe today, or was it last night, I was reading a story, and now there's another letter written for Tom Brady and this. And listen, I do understand. Tom Brady, he's doing what he thinks he has to do, and rightly so. I have no problems with that. You know, there's other issues that always come up. Would the NFL Players Association fight that hard if it was somebody else? You know, that... things like that kind of get in my head, and I just wonder, and my answer usually is probably not. But he is Tom Brady. He's a major focal point of NFL football and its history, and I hope it ends. Tired of talking about it. My opinions on it, Mike, have changed greatly. They have, yes. And in this way, when it first came out, you know, we were driving in a car from New England after they beat Indianapolis. I'm driving back to New York on that Sunday night, and one of the kids in the car who works with us, you know, they're all on their cell phones, and, oh, look, it just came out, Bob LeMay said the New England had footballs that weren't inflated enough, and I went, oh, my gosh, come on, you lose the game, be quiet. We thought nothing of it, and then, you know, one day later, it's the biggest sports story there is out there. But I did say this. I said, if it's true, if he did it, it's a big deal. I said it right away. I said it's a big deal. And there'll be suspensions and fines and this. And I actually even said, I think I said it on Boomer Esiason's show, I said they'll lose, there'll be a draft pick and this. I went on and I said, if it's true, if they can prove it. And as time has gone on, that stance, even if they prove it, has softened. And my stance now is I just wish it would end. And everybody could look at each other and go, we kind of proved our point, and let's just move on. That's really how I feel about it now. It's to the point I don't want to hear about it. I don't care. But that's not the way it's going to be, I guess. Sooner or later, something's going to happen. He's going to win it. It's going to be over. He's going to be retired, or he's going to have to serve that 4-game suspension. I don't know which, Mike. And quite honestly, I told you I read an article about it last night. I haven't followed that closely this offseason because I can't take any more of it. That's probably the biggest reason.
If it were you, if you were in his shoes, would you keep fighting?
Yes, I would. Absolutely. Without hesitation. And I would do it just as aggressive as he has done it. That's his right and his reputation. And I think at first, and two, I said this will really kind of follow him his whole career or his post-career if he's found guilty. But you know what? I don't feel that way anymore. And I don't even think it'll be a big deal. If he serves a 4-game suspension, it'll be a little footnote to Tom Brady's career. I don't know how you feel, but that's kind of how I feel about it now. And like I said, at first I thought, boy, it's just going to ruin so many of the great things he's done. Just the constant playing well, game after game, year after year. It's just I've never seen anything like it. And I thought that's going to really tarnish all that, but I don't think it will anymore. I think that we're in a different society. We forget, we forgive situations like this. We move on, and I don't think it's going to tarnish his legacy at all, even if he does serve a 4-game suspension.
Do you think it's worth it for the league to keep plotting through the courts with this? Phil, I wrote this. I wrote a variation of this. Bob Costas has said, isn't this a misdemeanor that got turned into a federal case?
Well, that's a whole other thing. You know, if you say if the league lets it go or whatever, then they have to let it go. So there's, you know, look, there's a precedent. There's so many things about it. You know, people say, hey, Phil, is it a big deal if the football is, if it's not the size it should be? And I said, well, I don't know. Let me shoot a basketball that's smaller. I'll throw it in the hole a lot more than I make. Let me play golf where the golf hole is bigger. I'll make more putts. And I said, you know, it's not only that, it's psychological too. So there's more to it than people just say, oh, it's nothing. I think it's a little more than nothing in that respect. Like I said, I hope it ends. I don't know if it will.
Yeah, and, it's never going to end. It's never going to end.
And I don't even know. I'm the one being interviewed. We're having this. You're doing your podcast. I really appreciate you having me on. What are your final thoughts right now? What do you want to see happen to this Tom Brady and Deflategate?
Well, when it first happened, before I had actually read all of that Wells report, I said he's gonna get 4 games. It's gonna get knocked down to 2. And then the more this thing began to unfold, and they made it act like destroying his cell phone was some sort of capital crime, and I'm thinking, is this America? I'm not giving up my cell phone to anybody. And it has reached the point where I hope he never does a day of time for this particular offense. And I wish we could take all of the, Philip, I wish we could take all of the legal fees, all of the money that has been spent on just lawyers in this case, and couldn't we give it to like wounded veterans? Couldn't this money have been spent more productively than on this?
Well, we're all geniuses after the fact, that's for sure. And I think, boy, knowing what we know now, would the league like to go back from the start and handle this whole thing differently? I would think they would. Let me ask you this way,
because I remember writing this early on in this thing. What if 4 days later, Tom had given a press conference and said, listen, these guys know how I like these footballs. You know, and I put a lot of pressure on to have them be absolutely to my right. specifications. And if they cross the line and they thought they were doing what I want, I'll have to take some responsibility for that and I'll have to wear it. Phil, if he'd said that the first week, is it $1 million? Is it a draft choice and it's four games? I don't think so.
No, it wouldn't have been. It would have cleared the whole thing up probably. But again, you know, when it happened, it was such a explosion. I don't know if you could think like that. And you know, so I don't know, Mike. I've heard that theory. If it had just done that, yeah, I think you're right. I think it would have calmed the whole thing down and we've moved on. And, you know, people, listen, when I played, hey, I was trying to get the footballs where I could at least hold them and grab them and stuff like that. And of course, what they're able to do now, would I do that? Absolutely. These footballs, they go out there and throw. Some days, I'll tell you, Russell Wilson, Tom Brady's, they're not, I don't know what the color for the football would be. I'd say it's black. It used to be like tan or, you know, that orange.
Right.
But they're able to rub them up and to get them to such preciseness, exactly how they want them, that's probably what led to a little trouble. But I don't blame the quarterbacks for doing it because it was always a big deal. Basically, every game of my career, the footballs were always on my mind because they were brand new, like throwing a rock. And if it was cold and windy in Giant Stadium, my gosh, I struggled enough as it was. In those days,
oh God,
it just got away from you constantly. So it's a great rule they passed because why make it so hard for these guys with great talent to throw the football that they can get them to these conditions? And I don't know. We'll find out if New England carried that too far.
Has this whole thing and whatever opinions you've had on this subject, has it affected your relationship with Brady at all?
Oh, no, not at all. No. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I don't think so. He's still very cordial to me. When we do games, we talk. So, you know, my opinions, you know, it gets to this. How can it affect it? He hasn't been found guilty or, you know, officially or anything like that. And like I said, my opinions, you know, I love this when writers do this. Hey, my opinions change all the time. And why do they change? Because I gather more information. I have more time
right.
to think about it, you know. Hey, it's amazing. Your opinion should change constantly about sports and players and people because we gather more information. And, gosh, there was a great quote, wasn't it? Muhammad Ali, or I don't want to even do it disservice. If you're the same person at 50 as you were at 20, you've wasted 30 years. So,
hey, did you ever meet him?
Yes, I did. Big fan, of course. I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. Listened to all of his matches when I was really young. My dad was a huge boxing fan, loved it. Loved Muhammad Ali. I would listen on the radio. I did all that stuff. Even when I was in college, I would listen on the radio, the round, round, round. You know, he'd be fighting in some foreign country. And I'd be going, oh, my gosh, he might lose it. I mean, I lived and died with it. Somebody said, who were your – I had Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, because living in Louisville, there was no Cincinnati Bengals when I was young. So the Cleveland Browns were our team. And Pete Rose from the Cincinnati Reds were my three guys. I mean, I lived
right.
and died with everything they did. And so, you know, Pete Rose, Charlie, he was Mr. Baseball for sure back then and loved the way he played and would get up every single day, look at the paper. I was a paper boy to see if Pete Rose, if he got any hits yesterday, I'd look at the box score. So one of the people that I just really, truly worshiped as a boxer and as an athlete.
I love the fact that they're bringing him home to Louisville at the end of the week. I wrote a column in the Daily News this morning, and the last two lines are, Louisville gave him to the world, and this weekend the world finally gives him back. I think it is going to be a beautiful couple of days in your hometown.
Yes, it will be. It will be. I went to, I can't remember what ceremony it was down in Louisville so many years ago, the Hall of Fame or whatever, and I remember him being there. And I got a picture with him, and I've heard many people write and listen on the radio. And, you know, I have a pair of his boxing gloves, too, with his autograph on them. And one thing about his autograph, I'm sitting here, I got one of Johnny Unitas and Joe Namath. They didn't sign an autograph. It is like a work of art. You can read every letter. It's perfect. And, you know, today's athletes, they scribble it. Muhammad Ali, you can see every letter and read it perfectly. And, this, you know, it's funny. I don't know why. Joe Namath the same way. And Johnny Unitas also. I'm looking at a football right now. Johnny, you can see every letter perfectly. It's really a work of art. So pretty cool.
Talking to my pal, Phil Simms, you have obviously been a sports fan your whole life. You are a quarterback. You are the father of quarterbacks. You have seen a lot in this sport. And I always said this, Phil, I think the most provocative conversation and the most fun and the most interesting is about quarterbacks in pro football. Who somebody thinks is the best? Who's on your top 10 list? There are so wildly divergent opinions. So let me ask you this. Who's the best you ever saw?
The best I've ever saw. Well, you know, I'm going to do it. There's so many answers, but I'm just going to say it this way. Physically, the best I've ever seen is Aaron Rodgers. He's the best I've ever seen physically. And he plays the position really well, too. So the throwing, the different throws, the speed, the touch, the feet, I mean, on and on. And, you know, I thought as I was – coming up or whatever. Of course, I was a big Roger Staubach, Terry Bradshaw fan. Got to play against both of them, which was really cool, too. But when I watched John Elway, Dan Marino, and Brett Favre, I said, you know, we'll never see quarterbacks like this ever again. I just said, there's no way. But I was wrong. You know, of course, we see more of them now than ever before. The talent level at quarterback is great. It's great. There are more than just a small group of guys that we put up there. There's many reasons why we only have a small group, because it's winning, the way we judge them, it's numbers, play, whatever. But Aaron Rodgers is John Elway, when I saw him in person, when I started announcing football, Mike, I went to a practice, I stood right behind him, and I just went, wow. You know, of course, I played against him, so you never give guys the credit they deserve when you play against them.
Right,
but I stood behind the practice, and I'm watching him going, damn, he's pretty good. and I covered him many years, so I got to see him have great success at the end of his career. And, of course, the same with Dan Marino. Before he started getting injured, Dan Marino was an absolute phenom. I mean, there's a group guy, Peyton Manning, for what he accomplished. I think people forget how good physically he was all the way up to that injury. He got better at throwing the football. He was a much better athlete at the quarterback position he got credit for. We see Tom Brady, and there's a large group of them out there right now that can really play. And Mike, who can really throw the ball. And that's not always the case, but guys that are exceptional throwers, if they got some of the other stuff, they get fortunate enough, they hook up with the right coach and organization, they have great success.
Phil, when you hear, you know, there's a certain narrative now, oh, they've made it as easy as they can for quarterbacks, they're trying to protect quarterbacks. When you played, and they're trying, and I don't have any problem with that, but when you played, do you think there was already the perception that it was far and away the most important position in sports? Because I don't even think there's any debate about that now. That it's
there's no debate now. No, I don't think it was back when we played. It was a different game, or when I played, I should say we. But when I played, no, it was thought of differently. And I don't think every team thought, oh, we just got to get the quarterback and we're going to be set. And that's the whole the whole thought of every organization and every owner, we got to have the face of the franchise, the guy, and all this other stuff. And it gets a little beaten up sometimes. But the position has changed. There's no question it's more important because there's been more put on the quarterback, mainly, in my mind, because of Peyton Manning, because what he did early in his career where he took over, called the plays, did all the checks, and through time, that just becomes, now that's a standard. You got to get that from every quarterback that's playing in the NFL now, because if you don't, you can't win. You can't afford to give up six plays a game that have no chance of working because the offensive coordinator called the wrong play. So it has changed. I understand all that. And let me tell you this, Mike. At first, I used to gripe, in a fun way, that they're making it too easy for the quarterback. You can't touch them. You can't do this. Well, I don't feel that way anymore because last year, I thought by and large, quarterbacks were just getting tore up. I saw as many big hits on quarterbacks last year that I've seen in many, many years. So I don't know if they can really protect them the way they hope to. Because defensive linemen, there's more of them. It's always a mismatch when you're talking about these great defensive line athletes and linebackers compared to offensive linemen. And the coaches are too smart. Oh, well, we'll keep extra guys in the block. Well, Wade Phillips says, you keep extra guys in the block, we're just going to send more people. And now everybody's one-on-one. And so you can't trick the players. You can't trick the coaches. And as I told a coach this year, hey, get your first-string starter a lot of reps. Get your second-team player quarterback. Make sure he's sharp. And have that third one getting oiled up in the bullpen because they're going to get hit. And what the draft, just real quick, think about the draft. It was incredible the number of, I thought, quality defensive linemen that came into the NFL this year. So,
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Hey, so your quarterback, Mike Carey, who stands in the booth with us the last 2 years, I kind of said some things to him the first year he was up there. This and that. He goes, Phil, you're wrong. I go, what do you mean I'm wrong, Mike? He goes, I stood behind these quarterbacks last year. I'm telling you, they get hit, and I can't believe they get up most of the plays. And I go, wow, really? He goes, yeah, you're watching on TV. You forgot. I'm telling you, they're, and he's right. I thought this past year, Peyton Manning took more big hits this past year than he took in the previous 8 years. And it's the same. Cam Newton, how about that beating he took in the Super Bowl? I mean, he needed to be Superman to survive. So it's the league is just the speed. And the quality of defensive front guys has changed so much that, boy, you better catch it and you better get rid of it quick and try to preserve your well-being back there as a quarterback.
We're talking to Phil Simms. Phil, I was talking to Herm Edwards a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about people don't make enough about how the headset has changed so much for quarterbacks in pro football to the point where Herm was saying, if you got a talented kid you think can play, basically the offensive coordinator is saying, don't worry about the huddle. You start walking up and I'll basically talk you through that. That's must be completely foreign to you the way you played the game.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's great for them. You know, they still have to have some signals, of course, in case the headsets go out, which they do every now and then during the NFL season. But you can give, I'm not sure. I think it's 15 seconds they cut them off where they can't talk to them. But the time the play is over, that's over 25 seconds that they're going to be able to start talking to the quarterback. Okay, it's third and six. Don't forget this. Don't forget that. Here's the two plays we want. You know, don't forget the checks. You know, it's amazing the language they can spit out. The quarterback, of course, knows it. They get all this information, and it makes it easier on them in that respect. That's why we see so many quarterbacks able to switch plays and do whatever, because if you get up the line of scrimmage quick enough and they line up, the whoever's talking to you, the coordinator, quarterback, coach, whatever, they can still say, hey, looks like it could be a blitz. It could be this. You still are gathering information at the line of scrimmage through your helmet, which is pretty good stuff. And it's good. I think it's kind of good for the game because we know we got to keep some offense in it. If we didn't have this situation going on, if they weren't changing plays, I don't know if the offense is to score near the points that they do now.
By the way, getting back to Aaron Rodgers for 1 second, and you're preaching to the choir with me on Aaron Rodgers. A couple of weeks ago, I went back and looked at those two throws against the Cardinals. Philip, those are the two greatest throws in the history of pro football.
They are. They're great. It's great. And, you know, the second one was a design play. He, in other words, they let the defensive end on purpose go inside so he could reverse out and do what he did. And there's not many teams that are going to design plays for the quarterback to scramble out of the pocket and, you know, throw a 60-yard line drive down the field or whatever. But it's unbelievable. I get to watch him in practice. I've seen it many times. I watch him warm up before the games. You know, Mike, he truly warms up. He throws about 10 balls. He goes, okay, I'm ready. I mean, so it's awesome. It's so natural to him. But think back to the Super Bowl they won down in Dallas. Think of the throws that he made that day. His first throw was like a 22-yard laser about 2 feet off the ground because it was in between a safety and another defensive back for a completion, the first play. And I went, wow, that's how you decide to start the game? You know, and he made, I'm going to say he made five or six. If you put them together, it's the best throws in Super Bowl history because every one of them was so physical. In other words, there's only a couple guys in the league that can make those throws given the chance, and he made every one of them that day, and that's why the Green Bay Packers won that game. It was awesome to see. And here's the other thing about Aaron Rodgers, because I've seen it in person. He went from not throwing the ball by NFL standards very well his first couple years in the league. His third year, I'm up there watching summer practice. And I'm talking to somebody with Green Bay, one of their personnel people on the sideline, but I'm watching out of the corner of my eye just seeing the field. And I remember going, man, that was a great throw by Brett Favre. And I turned, and it was Aaron Rodgers. I said, man, that was Aaron Rodgers that threw that? Wow, that didn't even look like him from last year. Then he walks over the sideline and says, hey, Aaron, good to see you. Good to meet you, you know, and this. I said, man, you know, don't take this the wrong way. I don't know how to say this, but wow, you look so different. You're throwing the ball. And he goes, oh, no, you're not offending me. He goes, I did this. And he started telling me, you're not going to get technical, all the stuff. And I went, well, man, Aaron, I'll just say this. It's working. And I really do believe that third year of his career, he threw the ball so outstandingly in preseason. And all the practices, that's when they said, okay, we have to get rid of Brett Favre and let this Aaron Rodgers play. And, of course, we've seen what's happened since.
By the way, and I don't want you to think I'm stuck on this, they have to change the coin flip rule in overtime in the playoffs. You can't let a scenario unfold the way it did against the Cardinals that Aaron Rodgers doesn't get to touch the ball, same as he didn't get to touch the ball the year before against the Seahawks.
Well, I don't know. You might be preaching to the wrong guy. You know, we talk about the players and health and all this, and, you know, you can't prolong it. That would always be my argument. Let's don't prolong the game any more than it is. So all you got to do is hold them to a field goal or less. Then you have great odds because now you have four downs to play with and to do it with because you know the situation.
Yeah,
so
but Phil, wait a minute. Wait a minute. This would be like in basketball if they said, okay, it's overtime now between the Cavs and the Warriors and LeBron. If Steph goes down and makes a three, you don't get to play anymore.
No. That's not a good analogy, no. There's many plays and many opportunities in football before. Hey, if they throw one pass and they go down and score, well, I don't know what to say. Then fire the player who gives it up and get rid of the coach for calling that defense. I don't know. So it's I understand what you're saying, but so you want them to play a 7-minute quarter? you know, whatever I...
You got to give the best player, you got to give the best player a chance to play because circumstances have taken him to the sidelines and he doesn't have anything to do. And I know it's a team game, but you 2 years in a row, Aaron Rodgers had to watch and never got to play any more football. You've got a billion-dollar business that comes down to a coin flip. How does that make any sense?
Well, I'm not saying it. I'm okay with the overtime rule the way it is. I think once they changed it to the field goal doesn't win it, that's when I really accepted it. And, again, my argument is, okay, if you want to make the overtime a six-minute period, a seven-minute period, I don't know. Again, the players are fatigued at that time. That's one of the reasons why we see scores is because fatigue becomes a factor, especially with the big people, so they're not quite the they don't have the presence and the playmaking ability in the fourth quarter and overtime that they did in the first three quarters. So I don't care what kind of shape you're in. When you're 320 pounds, it gets tired. I don't care how much you train. So I don't know. But my argument to you is just as simple. I don't want to see it prolonged much because I know that is not good for the players. And maybe in the playoffs I could stand a different rule because it means so much, the year and everything. But we talk about player health, and that's my argument. We prolong it even more, it just can't be good for the players.
Did you think, as your playing career was winding down, that you would ever be this much into a broadcasting career that has made you into one of these guys? And you're talking to somebody who used to watch you stand there and be totally stand up, win or lose, after the Giants played. But I tell people all the time, I had no idea you would be this good at this. Did you ever think you'd like it this much?
No. But, you know, it's kind of funny. I didn't really do much in my career as far as thinking that I'm going to play or, I mean, be an announcer or do football or anything, sportscasting, when I got done. I had lived my life and played my career, and in the back of my mind, there was always only one thing I was ever going to do when I got done playing. That was coach. And so my career ended abruptly without warning, and it caught me off guard. I didn't want to move to another team, so I was really in limbo there when the Giants let me go that summer or spring in 1994.
Yep.
And ESPN called my agent and said, hey, would he want to do an audition? And I thought, man, I don't know. I haven't thought about doing well, what do they want me to do? Well, I don't care. I said, I'll go do it. We're just going to talk football, right? I don't care what they ask me. I got an answer. And that was really, you know who I did it with? I did it with Mike Tirico. So he sat there. We sat at a desk. They asked me some questions. They showed some plays. I said, yeah, that's a such and such play. And Bill Walsh put that in 1978 or 79 when he went to the 49ers for the first year. Roger Craig made it famous. And they're like, wow, really? I said, oh, well, yeah, any play you show me, I can tell you where it started and who thought it up and how it came about and how everybody does it. And that's what got me a job there and moved me on. So I do like it. I like it a lot. I like being involved. I'm still intrigued by the thinking process, the way coaches handle players, you know, practice, you name it. It just the process does not get tiring as far as that. Of course, you know the downside of the job. You know what that is, right?
No.
Travel.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I know.
Travel.
I know.
Security lines. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my plane's late. Oh, what's happening? You know, so and that... So that part's
and on it and on ins and now you can tell the truth. This is a podcast, and even though we are having a rapidly growing audience, and inside the NFL, Phil, aren't you really the alpha dog? I mean, don't you really ultimately have the bona fides that say to those other guys, "Hey, I'm Phil Simms. Do you wear your Super Bowl ring just to let them know?"
Yeah, no, I don't. Who? I never wear my Super Bowl ring. No, and I would never do that. You know, people say things to me, Mike, and this and that, and I would never say that to Boomer because I know what a really that's a hurtful thing to say to other players, and you can't even really. I don't even kid about it. And you know, I've never said to somebody, never, you know, you don't know, you never played. I would never say that to anybody, because when you're involved in sports, you don't have to be a player to know certain feelings and all the other stuff that goes with it and what's around it. You don't have to be a writer. If you played sports growing up, those things that you remember and the qualities of the game and what made you love it and all the other stuff, it's the same as you go up the ladder. It just gets a little more notoriety. So, you know, as So I would never say that to anybody and discredit anybody saying, you don't know what you're talking about, you never played the game. Well, I just don't believe in that statement either.
And I'll tell you something. I can remember one time I was sitting in the press room at Shea Stadium with Tim McCarver when he was doing such an unbelievable job doing Mets games. And in the 68 World Series, the Cardinals had led 3-1. The Tigers came back, won the World Series. And I'm telling you, I innocently asked this question. I said to him, how long does it take you to get over something like this? And this was the old days, and he's smoking a cigar. He took off his reading glasses. He put them down, and he looked at me across the table, and he said, you never get over it. And I'll tell you something. I would never ask Boomer about that Super Bowl game against the 49ers. They did everything except win the game because, you know, one of the greatest players in the history of the game took his team over 90 yards. And I'm sure he thinks about that game a lot.
I'm sure he does. I can't imagine. You know, again, you know, you don't know what it is. When you're an athlete, I think especially once you get to the pros, you never think you're going to lose. You never think about anything that is how it's going to affect you. If you're going to think, you know, you don't do that. But but it does. I just think, oh, my God, what would my life be like if we lost that Super Bowl? What would it be like if I threw an interception that cost us to lose that Super Bowl? I think about somebody brought up Bill Buckner's name the other day, and I said, oh, gosh, that's heartbreaking to think about it. The Scott Norwood, even though it was against us, I go, oh, this it's, you know, he has to live with that every day. I'm sure I don't even know where Scott Norwood lives now. I've seen him on TV, but where he lives, it affects you. You don't get over it, and it affects your life, and that's the way sports is. I think that's what makes it so great sometimes, because there's so much on the line.
You know what? First of all, you've been great today. We're going to have to do this again, because as usual, when we get talking, I've thought of 20 things that I forgot to ask you today. But now let's just circle back to the way this began, okay? That question I asked you on that day before the Super Bowl in January of 1987, when we look back now and we see how you played, I just have one thing to say to you. You're welcome.
There you go. Okay. That's very good. You know, I think of that. There are many things about the Super Bowl I think about. But that question from you, and I'll make this quick. The other thing, and I don't know if I've ever told you this, stop me if I have. On Friday night before the Super Bowl, I had dinner with Billy Crystal. Me, Phil McConkie, and Billy Crystal. And I can't remember who the fourth person was there, a friend of his. It was supposed to be Rob Reiner, but Rob Reiner couldn't make it. So Billy Crystal turns to me during the dinner. It's kind of getting, the final 10 minutes we're going to be there. And he turns, he just goes, what can you tell me about the game? Just can you tell me anything? I said, sure, what do you want to know? And he goes, well, what are y'all going to, I said, Billy, here's what's going to happen. On the first play of the game, we're going to run a play-action fake. I'm going to throw the Lionel Manuel over the middle of the field. It's probably going to pick up 20 yards. Picked up 22, I think. He goes, really? I said, yeah, it's guaranteed. We got the scouting. I know it's going to happen this way. They're going to double mark Bavaro. It's going to happen. In that second play, we're going to run this other play. We're going to shift. We're going to go to formation. I'm going to throw it to Mark Bavaro. And boom, we get near the goal line. We got this play. We got a good flea flicker. So I'm telling him all this, and he's like going, really? So he tells the story. And, of course, only he can do it this way. He sits in the stands. He's there, watching with all the Giant fans. And he tells them all, hey, listen, everybody, the first play, Phil's going to throw a pass to Lionel Manuel over the middle for a big game. And they're all going, nah, shut up, Billy. You don't know anything. No, he told me, shut up. So it happens. And all of them just go, turn and look at him and go, oh, my God, now what are they going to do? He goes, he's going to throw it to Mark. So the first couple plays went exactly like I told him. And, of course, the whole game, they're going, what do you think Bill's going to do? What's Phil going to – and so for him to tell the story, when he told it, I actually saw him do it on TV, was hilarious. And so that I remember that. Of course, the Disney World commercial. And I put your question right up there with it. I think of that all the time. I probably tell the story once a month to somebody about you asking me that question or giving me that statement. And so it's great memories, and I can't believe how – man, Mike.
I know.
How many years ago was that now? We're going to be going on
moving
30
up
years.
On this January, it'll be 30 years, Philip. But one thing has not changed. First of all, thank you for doing this. You know, not enough good things can ever happen to you to suit me. And I'll talk to you soon, pal.
Well, same to you. Thank you for having me on, Mike, and we'll be in touch. Thank you.
Phil Simms, I've told you about this podcast before. These are the types of guests we're going to have, and I hope that you feel at the end of everyone that you want it to go on for another hour, because I got another hour of questions for him. Please subscribe, because if you continue to subscribe and to finance this show, I've told you, we'll do it from now until the end of time. Talk to you next week.
Mike Lupica Show is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search Mike Lupica Show. Click on the Mike Lupica Show icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.